Hello, everybody. This is Michael Spencer, the Internet Monk. It's a beautiful day, April the 17th, 2007. It's a sad day in our country, as all over America. We're mourning the loss of 32 people slaughtered on the campus of Virginia Tech University. And on today's podcast, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about some of the things I've been sharing with our students and staff these last couple of days. If you know anything about contemporary Christian music, you may recognize that we've been listening to John Michael Talbot. And the piece that you were hearing is called The Apostles' Creed, and it's from an album called The Lord's Supper. It's one of John Michael Talbot's oldest pieces of music, and if you don't have it, try to get it. I would assume that at John Michael Talbot's website, you might be able to find what's currently out there, or find it on a used music store. The Lord's Supper by John Michael Talbot, some absolutely wonderful classical folk rock compositions there that I really treasure. And the Apostles' Creed just seemed like the thing to share today. Well, as I said, I've had the opportunity to talk about this tragedy in West Virginia with a lot of our students. Those of us who are in education feel kind of bound together with anybody who goes through this kind of violence on their campus. I was just reading about some of the amazing sacrificial behavior of teachers who put themselves between the shooter and students at the cost of their own life. You always see pictures of Christ in this kind of suffering, and you always see pictures of the best. You know, when you have the worst of human beings, it always brings out the best of human beings at the same time. I've had the opportunity to talk to our kids because we've been concerned about a couple of our graduates who are students at Virginia Tech. We heard from them today, and they were well, though one of them said that he had dropped a class with one of the professors who was killed in February and could very well have been in that building. So he was grateful for God's providence, even as he was grieving the loss of classmates and friends. One of the things that I think is most important for us to do when we have this kind of event is to realize that we as Christians are not called upon to do a lot of talking. We need to pray. We need to weep. We need to be in solidarity as human beings with this terrible human experience. There is a wonderful lesson in the Bible in the fact that Job's friends came and said nothing for 7 days. And it was when they began talking and sharing their theology and all of their expertise on the mind of God and all of their expertise on exactly how God works and why certain things happen. So when they began doing that things went downhill. And of course, if you read that book of Job, which so many people don't read, that the central section, they avoid it like the plague. But if you will read it, you'll discover that they're not only unhelpful to Job. God, at the end of the book, actually commends Job and denounces the friends. And Job had kind of thrown a fit of his own and had said a lot of things that I'm sure you wouldn't say if you knew you were standing face to face and nose to nose with God. But Job is commended for his laments and his anger, while his friends are denounced as being wrong while they were sharing everything they had underlined in their theology books. If you don't have in your personal worship time and in your corporate worship time structured time to pray for particular kinds of suffering, hunger, disease, the suffering of innocence, violence, if you don't have that, you need to do that. All of us know that evangelicals left alone we'll wind up praying about a lot of trivial and silly things, our own agendas and our own concerns, which frequently have very little to do with the kingdom, will wind up being front and center. At Soli Deo, one of the things we've done is we have a section of our prayer time where we go through a short list of things that we want to be sure and pray for. and the suffering of innocent peoples on that, as well as peace in the world, peace in the Middle East, healing for those who are sick, that those who don't know Christ would come to know him, the unity of the church around the world. These are things that we always pray for, and then we have an open time of prayer where people can pray for whatever they want. But that structured prayer time is to keep us on track and to not forget people dying of AIDS, people who are cold and hungry, refugees, those affected by war, those who are suffering in their own homes and families right down the road from us, people who need our prayers. While we have health and life, we need to pray for those who are in any way suffering. And I hope you'll structure your own prayer time so that that won't be something that you overlook, or that you only wind up praying whenever something like this happens. We have a tendency to let our prayers be too much driven by media anyway. I wonder how many churches wind up praying for Anna Nicole Smith's baby because somebody had watched it on TV all the time. We have a Bible that opens our eyes to God's kingdom agenda, to his concerns for justice, the poor, the widow, the hungry, the orphan, as well as the growth and spread of his kingdom, the growth and propagation of the gospel. There's a whole prayer agenda right there. And we need to discipline ourselves to pray and to sometimes have little to say and to always be in solidarity, just human solidarity, with people who've gone through loss, and not feel like it's our job to bring a bucket of answers and a bag full of theology to the funeral home or the hospital. Another thing that is always going to come up in a time of national tragedy, particularly this kind of tragedy, violence perpetrated against innocent people, one of the questions that's bound to come up is the question from the unbeliever of how can you believe in a God who could stop this and doesn't? I think that's a great question. And I want to tell you, anybody who's a Christian who reacts hostily to that question as if, how dare you ask me that, you really need to get down off your horse and understand that this, whoever's asking you this, is right on the money. I mean, the Psalms ask that question over and over and over. God, how can you let this go on? There's nothing wrong with that question. In fact, I think I would tell somebody, you just ask a question that many believers in the Bible ask. You're asking verbatim a question that David asked, that Habakkuk asked, that Job asked. It's also a great opportunity, I think, to do some teaching. And one of the things I would say is, would you let me explain to you two or three things about the Bible that I think are important? It may not change your mind, but if I can explain these things, you may see a little better about why many of us continue to believe in the Christian God, even though, yes, we believe God could, quote, stop this. And then I would go through something like this. The Bible tells us that God created a perfect world where none of this happened, where there wasn't any violence of this sort. But our first parents rebelled against God and fell into the condition of being sinful rebels in God's world, and everything about us was affected. And one of the things that was affected was that we became capable of real violence. And the Bible shows us that, in that the first sin was something that we look at as being a small thing, is breaking a commandment about don't eat of a particular fruit. But the second sin that's detailed in Genesis 4 is a brother murdering a brother. So we are violent. Fallen human beings are violent. God created us with these incredible capacities because it says we're made in his image. So we've got creativity, and we've got energy, and we have power. All these things that God gave us to be used rightly, and as we've rebelled against God, we use them wrongly. And one of the things we do is we turn on one another. And you can see that beginning with just jealousy and blame and moving right on up to murder by Genesis 4. So now in the Christian story, God has a decision to make. If we can compare God to a human mind, obviously God's mind operates on a whole different plane. But to kind of put God's thoughts together in a human way, I can just hit the delete button and wipe all of this out, or we can proceed on. Well, in Genesis chapter 6, it is very interesting that it specifically spells out that violence was one of the things that prompted God to send a worldwide judgment. And I always like to point this out to people because many folks just think that this story of the flood was just God wanted to flood the world. But you can see very clear, Genesis 6:11, the earth was corrupt in God's sight and filled with violence. Filled with violence. And that's not the only time that that comes up. God is greatly disappointed in human beings because every thought of their heart is evil all the time. But in Genesis 6:13, it says the earth is filled with violence. So behold, I'll destroy them from the earth. And so in the Bible's narrative, you have a flood that is sort of hitting the delete key. God saves one man and his family. God shows incredible grace and mercy to one man and his family. And to make a long story short, that family becomes the seed for a repopulated earth, which is once again full of selfish, violent, arrogant, ingenious sinners. So by the time you get to the 11th chapter of the first book of the Bible, you have a perfect world that's ruined. You have God bringing a worldwide judgment on that world, which it obviously deserved. In other words, stopping the violence, which is what we all want God to do. And then the human race continues as sinful as ever. And at this point, God makes another decision. And this is the decision that your friend who asked the question is really perceiving. God decides how he's going to be involved with this world. Is he going to just wipe it off? Is he going to hit the delete key and wipe everybody off the face of the planet? Or is he going to let the world proceed in a broken condition? And I want to be very clear with people that fundamental to the Christian view of reality is that God decided to let the world proceed on in a broken condition. A violent world, a selfish, arrogant, painful world, a world filled with beauty and the possibility of kindness and compassion and all kinds of wonderful things because we're still made in God's image and we're still capable of all those things, but sin has perverted and corrupted. And frankly, were it not for God's goodness and kindness, we'd be even worse than we are. But human beings are a violent bunch. And God has decided to let the world proceed on like that. So you are right. God has decided that this world will continue on as a violent place. And that because we are made in the image of God and we can take those great gifts of love and creativity and power and we can twist and pervert them, and they are twisted and perverted in this fallen world, in criminals and mentally ill people and in every one of us to some extent, you have events like we've witnessed this week at Virginia Tech. It's always important, I think, to say that as you run through the Bible never blinks about this. There's violence all over the place. There is great suffering, and the Bible never calls it anything but great suffering. When Herod kills the innocent children, it's a terrible thing, and it's something to weep about. And Christians don't have some, you know, schmaltzy Eastern religion. If you can meditate your way to the right place, you know, this all looks different. This is not Joel Osteen's, you know, well, this is your best life now. You obviously didn't confess faith enough and, you know, you didn't believe enough and you've brought this on yourself. It's not blamed on the devil. It's not said, okay, well, this doesn't happen except when the devil occupies somebody and then you have this kind of violence. No. Jesus said in Mark chapter 7 that every kind of violence, every kind of sin, every kind of perversion was present in the human heart. And put people in the right situation, allow events to happen to them, allow them to interact with each other in particular ways, and you get this sort of thing. You could take away the names and turn down the voices, and you could put us on the Discovery Channel, and we would do just fine. We're a violent species. We just don't eat each other. But we do terrible things to each other. And now let's be blunt. The reason that we are shocked is because this slaughter happened where it's not supposed to happen, where we have fenced off in our mind, well, this doesn't happen. But if you heard a report today that 32 people died in a bus bombing in the Middle East, you wouldn't be shocked. Or that 32 died in the war in Iraq, you wouldn't be shocked. Or that 3,200 died from a disease or AIDS or hunger or poison water, we wouldn't be particularly shocked. Or that 32 died in many other ways. Human beings have a violent world on their hands. God is in this world with us. God in Jesus Christ is in this world with us. God's Spirit is in this world with us. Jesus stood in that Jordan River right next to sinners and was baptized with them because he's one with us. And he's come into our brokenness. And that's what Christians need to do. We need to move into the suffering and move into the hurt and move into the ignorance. We need to go to the places where people are living broken lives, like Appalachia and the inner city and Indian reservations and wherever. We need to go there, and we need to be present, and we need to be who we are, and we need to do good in the name of Jesus Christ. And we need to be very idealistic about it, but we also need to be realistic about it. We need to be very idealistic about it for Christ's sake, but we also need to be realistic about it and realize that it is the world God created, but it's also the world that Solomon described in Ecclesiastes and that David wrote about in the Psalms and that Habakkuk lamented over. Lord, how can you let these kinds of things happen? So could God stop it? God's decision to not stop things like this isn't so much event by event, though that's certainly part of God's sovereignty, but it's not going to do you any good to think about it like that, I can assure you. God's decision is this world will proceed on, broken as it is. His judgment, his redemption, his salvation will be worked out in this world. This is the world he loves. These are the people he loves. This is the world he's going to save. This is the world he's going to transform and resurrect. This is the world we go to. And we prefer to enter into the suffering as well. Read this wonderful thing on Challies today. He was giving some reports from a minister in the Virginia Tech area. And he said they had a prayer meeting. It was a great prayer meeting. And that the pastor of the local AMIA, that's Anglican Mission in America Church, spoke and read a letter from the Anglican Bishop of Rwanda, who is the bishop for AMIA churches. And he said, remember the suffering of your African brothers and sisters a decade ago, and how they lost tens and tens and tens of thousands. And that he said, here's some prayers that were meaningful to us. And the suffering we have to go through here seems very out of place in our secure country and our university campuses, our schools, our neighborhoods. But this world is a very insecure, dangerous place. And God's grace is at work in such a place. Isn't that amazing? God loves and is at work in such a place. And he started with Abraham and moved right on to his son Jesus, nailed to the cross, beaten, brutalized, suffering for us. The very epitome of the Christian message is the suffering of our Savior. And that doesn't take away the tears, but it validates the tears, and then you have the resurrection on the other side, which says, this is not all there is. This is not all there is. God is going to raise up and make new even such a world. I think that's really amazing. Amazing grace. One other thing I've talked to my students about today, and I don't know if my podcast audience maybe feels like this is as relevant as some other things I might talk about, but let me just say this. There are a lot of people around us who do not know how to cope with very ordinary things in life. One of the things we've learned from these violent incidents down through the years is that there are people who cannot deal with rejection. They can't deal with disappointment. They cannot deal with teasing, taunting. And our culture, one of their responses is to say, well, these things shouldn't be there. We should never be teasing. There should never be taunting. There should never be disappointment. And that's just ridiculous. You know, I like to think of, you know, that little kind of fat, pudgy kid who goes out for baseball, and there he is out in right field, and he drops a ball, and, you know, some people boo, and some people call him a name. And mama wants to run out and say, well, I don't want anybody taunting or booing at my little boy, so you either make the fans go away, or I'm going to take him home. You know, the good coach has to say, ma'am, starting out in right field means you're probably not the best fielder in the team. You're not the best athlete. You need to work on catching the ball, but you're going to drop a few. And when you drop a few, you're going to get a few boos. And every baseball player knows that and accepts that. Every pitcher, every batter, everybody catching a ball knows that you take the good with the bad, and that's how you become a player. Everybody who's out there is not just somebody who is immune to life's difficulties. And I watched Ken Griffey Jr., Hall of Fame player, now playing right field for the Reds, bobble and drop a nice little easy right field play the other day. And probably a few people booed him, but he knows how to get right out there and play, do his job. There are a lot of people that don't know how to cope. I don't know if we've stressed self-esteem too much. I don't know if there are some people who just don't pick up the message that, you know, true love often ends in tragedy, it often ends in disappointment. That nothing good lasts forever, and that some good things don't last very long at all. I don't know if we are just psychologically fragile, but there are a lot of people around you who have got coping problems, and some of them get depressed. Not, you know, to say that every depressed person just needs to learn how to cope. I realize it's more complicated than that. But some people, when they are disappointed or humiliated, they get hopelessly depressed. Some people, when they lose a job or lose a friend or a relationship comes to an end, they become bitter, angry, even possibly violent towards themselves or someone else. Be aware and be helpful to folks like that. Provide some feedback. Provide some encouragement, some life lessons to people who may think, man, I just can never get over this. Human beings are amazingly resilient in the right kind of community. You know, we're not made to be, you know, where we can't be broken. We're not break-proof by any means, but in the right kind of community, we can cope with a lot, you know. Right kind of community, people cope with war, they cope with being refugees, they cope with death. People bury their spouses and their children, they go on. There's so many examples of ways that, as human beings, we can move through things that seem like they're overwhelming. And that's, of course, the kindness and goodness of God that's manifested. But I just want to say, on a very practical level, look at that person next to you at work that's lost a spouse, or look at that person in your dormitory who's lost a girlfriend, and go that extra mile to become a friend, to listen, and maybe to even say, I could tell it's really eating you. You know, that you've lost something or that you've gone through this tough time. And let me encourage you that you're going to make it. I want to help you make it. Who knows, the right kind of friendship, which is difficult with really sick people, I know. Difficult with really bitter, angry people. But the right kind of friendship can even save lives. The right kind of compassion and community for one another. And we have so many people, as I said, who just don't know how to cope with the smallest things. When I read about so many of these things that have happened in schools, I'm amazed at the smallness of what got under the skin of these kids, and how the community that they then formed was one that festered and fostered more resentment and more bitterness. And there was that opportunity for a different kind of community and quite possibly a different kind of result. Well, Virginia Tech, we're praying for you. Praying for you guys, and I hope that all over America, anybody who hears this podcast will be in prayer at least once or twice today, this week, for all those events and all those people who are touched, for ministers who are working through this and preaching and praying, counseling. We're praying for you guys too. So this is the Internet Monk, Michael Spencer. This has been Internet Monk Radio, podcast number 55. Until next time, I'll see you.